Good day, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Extra Point Podcast. Really glad you're listening today. My name's Todd Stiles. Today's Tuesday, July 30th, and glad you're tuning in. We want to take some time on this episode to answer three questions that came in over a week ago. They are concerning the general text in Colossians 3, in which Paul discusses, under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, both the putting off and the putting on of putting off the sins and putting on those things that are righteous acts. Now, just to remind you, I spoke mainly about the putting off aspects. Travis spoke last Sunday about the putting on aspects. These questions pertain mainly to those things that relate to putting off sins. And so I want to address these three questions today. The first one really is a question that takes a number of the sins from Colossians 3, 5 and Colossians 3, 8 and simply asks this: can you define more practically what is considered sexual immorality, slander, malice, and filthy language? Now, she chose 5 out of the 2 lists. My sense is maybe she's curious about multiple sins in here, like the definition, the practical implications or practical meaning of these words. And so I'm going to take some time, if I could, and just kind of walk you through these. It'll be somewhat brief. But the list in Colossians 3, 5, here it is in the CSB. We're exhorted to put to death these things. They belong to our earthly nature, and there are 5 that are listed: sexual immorality, impurity, lust, evil desire, and greed. And I made the suggestion that perhaps Paul is moving from the large to the small. He has a broad category of sexual immorality, those external actions, and he seems to move in this list to where the central thing that's motivating those externally sinful actions, which is greed. And in the next list, verse 8, he seems to do the opposite. He starts with the internal motive first, which is anger, and he moves to how that's exhibited in our external actions by talking about things like malice or filthy language or slander. And so these lists seem to work in opposite directions, yet they're both a list of sins that we should put off. And her question is, you know, can you define more practically what that means? So let's take a shot at that, can we? Let's see if we can get some insight into these sins. I'll begin with the first list, Colossians 3, 5, sexual immorality. The word here is porneia, and it is generally used as an umbrella term for sexual sin of a physical nature. Some would include lust in here, or maybe you could say sexual sin that does not involve someone else. Others would say perhaps porneia relates to sexual sin with someone else of various types, whether it be fornication or adultery, so forth. Make your best judgment on that. The word here simply is an umbrella term for sexual sin. I would remind you of this one fact, and this is something for you to ponder and think about. This is the same word used when Jesus said this is the only exception given for divorce. In other words, this word adultery, sexual immorality, it's the same word used there when Jesus says no man should put away his wife except for adultery. It's the word porneia. Here the word is porneia. So if you maintain that sexual immorality here includes sins that are sexual but aren't with someone else, it will probably follow then, it would demand some consistency that you would say you could divorce your spouse for the same reason. This may be why some would say that the word refers only to sexual sin with someone else. There's a physical nature to it with another person, because then that would be the reason you would be allowed to divorce. So just keep that in mind. The word here is porneia. It's a range of sexual sins physically. Then the next word, of course, is impurity. He does seem to begin already moving towards these types of sexual sins that are not just external or physical. Here, this word really speaks to that which is inside a person that perhaps is hidden and yet vile and unclean. It's used in Matthew 23 to speak of the scribes and Pharisees when Jesus said that you appear beautifully outward, but you are inside full of all uncleanness. It's also used in Romans chapter 1, where it says that God gave them up to uncleanness through the lusts of their own hearts, and they began then to dishonor their own bodies. And so the sense here of this word is that he's already moving towards that which is internal, and it's that which then shows itself externally through the first word, which is porneia or sexual immorality. So impurity here would be, perhaps I would say, hidden uncleanness, that which you're trying to hide. You don't want anyone to know about, but you're kind of the secret sins, we'll call them. And in this case, I think the general usage does point to that of a sexual nature. It is closely aligned to the next word, which is lust. The word here technically is just the word for passion. And it again, refers to what's internally going on, a strong desire. And of course, that fits the next word. It's called evil desire. Now, interestingly, in the original text, the word desire is not in there. It's just the word for evil. Now, evil, this word here, is typically used as an adjective to describe a person, such as Matthew 21, talking about wicked men. Mark 7, out of these men come evil thoughts. So there are some times it's used in other ways. Pilate did use this word when asking the crowd, you know, what evil has Jesus done? But there he's really asking this question, like, if he's done these wrong things, you know, what's prompted this man to do this? So the word has a sense in which it is always applied to a character, or it's looking at someone's totality or who they are, like they're just an evil person. You're speaking there not only of their actions, but of kind of the way they're wired, so to speak. And so here the CSB does add the word desire as a way to get to the heart of the meaning of the word here, which I think brings some affirmation to the way Paul is structuring his list. He does seem to be moving more and more towards the inner desire, which feeds those externally sinful actions. So here's the list again. Sexual immorality, that's the word porneia, a broad umbrella term for sexual activity that's wrong in a physical sense with someone else. That's what I would hold to the word meaning. Impurity, lust, and evil desire are three words that point to the internal aspects of sexual sin, such as lust. The word, of course, for lust here in this text is pathos or passion. Here it'd be wrong passion pointed in the evil, lustful direction. Of course, then the word evil or the word evil desire. And then, of course, it ends with greed, which is simply wanting more than what you have. Another word used here is covetousness. So you get the sense that here's what's happening inside a person. It's covetousness. It's wanting more than they have sexually, outside of the boundaries or realms that God has established, whether for single people or married people. And so because of this greed of wanting more, this covetousness, and I would add probably in this text, sexual covetousness, then they begin to have evil desires that have misdirected passions or lusts, and that exemplifies itself then in impure or unclean, or as the King James calls it, inordinate affections and passions that ultimately display themselves in wrong sexual behavior with someone else. So that's maybe some practical understandings of this first list. I would say it's often seen played out in our lives, I would say, through, first of all, feeding these wrong kinds of passions through social media, streaming channels, various forms of pornography. We feed our wrong and sinful nature, and it can then breed and bring up in us a covetousness for more than what we have outside of the boundaries that God has given us. And then we, unfortunately, act on those at times in sinful external ways. And so that's one of the ways we see this list playing out in 2024. It starts with an internal small desire fed by our culture, and then it plays out in behavioral ways that are wrong. So I hope that helps a little bit with seeing how this list displays itself practically. But then we come to this next list, in which he does the opposite. He goes in the opposite direction. He starts small and gets bigger. And the very first word in verse 8 is the word anger. It's a very interesting word. It's the word for wrath. And it's used a lot in the New Testament of God's wrath and his sentence, his judgment upon the disobedient. There's several verses in which we see this. Matthew 3, 7, Luke 21, John 3. And so here's my best take on why I think this word is used. I think what Paul is getting at is he's saying that what we want to guard against and what we want to put off is this posture where we've already given a sentence, we've judged, we've handed down a verdict on someone internally. We've made our minds up and we are going to now be angry with them. We're going to let them feel our wrath. It's the internal. You could even use the word hidden in the sense that we've not verbalized anything yet, but we've kind of reached a decision within ourselves that, you know what, I'm now going to make sure they pay for something. They're going to experience my wrath. And then that is displayed in the following ways, such as in our wrath, our malice, our slander, or our filthy language. The word wrath is the root word from which we get our word thermos. Interestingly, it probably means you're bottling something up and then you explode, like you're keeping something in that's really, really hot. You let the top off and then it comes out. And so here he's saying you've made your mind up to sentence someone, to judge them, to put them under your wrath, and then it finally comes out in an explosion. What's been hot for all this time is revealed. He then talks about malice, which interestingly, in its spelling, is very close to the word for evil in the first list, but it simply means to wish injury or wickedness upon someone, to see them injured or hurt. And then, of course, you have words like slander, is to use your words to malign them, to spread rumors and falsehoods about them so that their character and reputation is harmed. It's untruths that are spoken verbally. And then, of course, filthy language, which I think in this context, he's speaking here then of going beyond even just lying and then using a vile, evil words in the lying. So it's one thing to say an untruth with regular words, if I can even use this analogy, but now to add cursing to the lies would just be an escalated version of the malice. It's filthy language. It's a vile, impure, coarse language that would be attached to words meant to hurt and injure. All of this, of course, is stemming from this internal disposition that you've settled on to judge someone, to sentence them, because you're upset, angry, and you are now going to exercise your wrath. And so what's been bottled up inside and is starting to come out, and it comes out in these various ways. So what you have here really are these two lists. I hope those explanations and definitions will give you some practical insight. We see these sins play themselves out in a number of ways. They may be centuries old because they're in the text, but I'll tell you they're not centuries old when it comes to how we see them. And so let's pray for each other. Let's work as God's people with the Lord in our sanctification so that we do what verse 5 says and what verse 8 says. We put to death the things that belong to this first list, and we put away all the things in this second list. Those are the things with the old self, and those are the things that we want to put off, put away, and put to death. Now, one of the things that I mentioned when I spoke mainly about putting off some of these things was that there is a gap between putting off and putting on that we know exists. We're not putting things on perfectly. We still fight sin because it's present with us. And so often our intentions are bigger and greater than our actions. And so I try to address this fact that there is this gap. There's this dilemma that we find ourselves in between what we've put off and what we've put on, and we want to do it better and more in God's power and more to His glory, and yet we still struggle. And it was to this dilemma, it was about this gap, that I had this next question come in. It's from a parent, and in all frankness, I misunderstood the question when I read it live in the service. Perhaps I was more nervous than I realized. Perhaps I was just not as cognizant of what they were after. It seems a little more clear now in this format. This person did write in and just explain things a little more clearly. But here's the question they asked. I wish I would have done a better job with it in the service. But they asked this question: what advice would you give to parents of children who are saved, but these children feel very heavily the weight of the gap between what they should do versus what they actually do? And as she explained to me in her text, she was just simply saying that her child has a high sensitivity to what the Lord wants in his or her life, and yet they feel like they're falling short. They have great desires, and yet any type of disobedience, they're very moved by it. They're quickly discouraged by it. And so she was writing in to say, I think our child is moving along in a good way in his spiritual development, but any type of disobedience or any type of awareness of this gap, you know, between what we want to do and what we actually do, it really bothers them. They're highly sensitized to it. What's a parent to do in that case? And so now that I understand the question more, there's probably a number of things you could say, some books you can recommend. I would just say one thing. I would say, first of all, congratulations that you're aware of your child's emotional journey, kind of where they are, their disposition, kind of how they're reacting to things. Your awareness is a large part of dealing with things. And so I'm really glad to see and to hear that you're seeing this, you're aware of it. And then I would speak into that, and I would just encourage you. Here's the one thing I would say amidst a host of things you could say and read. I would just say this, first of all: make it a point to be a positive source of encouragement in your child's life every single day. I'm not meaning here to go above and beyond or overboard in a weird way and pretend that things aren't what they are. But I think letting your awareness be known to him, making it clear that you're in the struggle with him, and then to walk with him in an encouraging way. One ratio that we used with our kids was this: we would try every day to make sure that for every negative thing we had to say, and there are those times you have to correct, instruct, you've got to reprimand, but for each one of those, 7 positives. And we would try to make sure that our positives really focused on character, not just on outward conduct or appearance. And there are times you want to commend that as well. But you want to commend and note in a positive, encouraging way those things that are coming from the inside. And you want to do that, way more than you do the negative. And because you're aware of this, and because perhaps you're saying that they're struggling when the negative pops up, that gets them down pretty quickly, I would encourage you, board that train, make your awareness known to him, and then just overly and overtly make sure that the positive is the overall tone in your home and in your conversations and interactions with him. That's where I'd start. More than likely, that will blossom and unfold into other things that you can do, tactics and strategies you can take, because that will breed more conversation. It will reveal further insights. But I would start there. Much good can come from simply encouraging the good that we see, affirming the positive that we are able to observe, and then maximizing that to its fullest. So I'd simply say to you, your awareness is a wonderful thing. So use that awareness to spot the situation and speak into the positive, and then trust the Lord as He leads you from there into what to say and do next. Lastly, a question concerning the final word in the list in Colossians 3:8. This person asks, how would you address those who debate what quote-unquote filthy language is? That's the last word in Colossians 3:8. I continue with the question. Some Christians find some words acceptable that others don't. Should we consider what culture says about filthy language? So there's three questions here, all wrapped up into one, or maybe I should say technically two questions. The first one's more a statement, but a really good question. I want to maybe take them in reverse order. He says, lastly, should we consider what culture says about filthy language? Well, I think we should. That doesn't mean they set the standard. Does it mean that they set the bar or they determine always what's right or wrong? But should it affect or should we consider what they say about it? I think we should at least make that part of the equation by asking ourselves, how is a certain word being used currently in our culture? And then that should affect not only if we use it, but that should affect perhaps when we use it. If we think, well, the word itself isn't bad, but I do want to use it in the right way at the right time around the right people, because it can be misinterpreted, it can be misapplied. And so those things are always on our radar. And so just be aware of that. To answer the last part of the question, there are some words in which we'll want to consider what the culture says about them. Some Christians find some words acceptable that others don't. What about that situation? That's a great question. Perhaps answering that, it's best to go to what the word in the text actually means, which is what you ask first about the phrase or the word filthy language. The word here really means low or obscene language, or a low or obscene word. And so the key here is the word obscene. And so I do think he's speaking here in some ways, perhaps to, a sense of like a sexually obscene word, or a word that has obscenity attachments, those kinds of elements inherent in the word. So I think we want to be very careful there. I would say there are words that have obscene attachments that aren't classified as what our culture knows as cuss words. I don't want to in this podcast go into those. I don't always know who's listening. I know we have some families who listen together. And so I want to just ask the parents here in this case, be aware that there are words that aren't technically a culture's cuss words, but they have obscene implications. And I would encourage you, ban those words from your family's usage. There are other words that they're not wrong, but our culture has made them wrong. And so when you use them, how you use them should be considered. That's the last part of his questions. Again, we're letting the Bible set the parameter. So my answer in the simplest way to his question is this. When he says, how would you address those who debate what filthy language is? I would say we're going to let the Bible answer the question, and that any word or phrase that's obscene, that has a low value when it comes to the things that God has said are sacred, you know, especially when it comes to those things of a sexual nature, things that demean and lower God's standard and God's ideal, words that make those things obscene and no longer sacred, we don't want to say those words. We don't want to use those words. And so don't. Just as the text says here, put those off. Put those away. Put those to death. And I'd remind you that that list probably doesn't include the technical list of cuss words, yes, but it may include other words that maybe aren't on that list but have those implications. And so I want to encourage each family to think through the language they use, the way that language is used, how they talk about sexual things, how they talk about others, which is really, when it comes to this list of our language sins, it is in regards to a posture of judgment, or a situation in which we sentence someone to a verdict in our hearts, and then we act on that. And so anytime you use language that's obscene or low or sexual in nature or misrepresents God's intentions, that's filthy language. Don't use it. It may be more for sure, but it's at least that. And so analyze your family's dictionary, okay? Take a look at your vocabulary words. Ask yourself, are any words or phrases we're using, are they attached to things that demean or lower God's standards? Do they have obscenities either inherent or explicit in them? And if so, then just simply say to your kids and together, say, you know what, our family, we don't use these words because they're in this category of filthy language. Well, I hope my insights to those questions has helped a little bit. There's no doubt in all three of those questions more that we could say, but let's at least pray that the least we've said today will be used by God to help you further your sanctification as you seek to put to death, put away, and put off the old self, and to put on the new self, which is being renewed in knowledge after our Creator.
Thanks for listening to the Extra Point Podcast. To find more content and resources to grow deeper in your relationship with Jesus, go online to firstfamily.church/resources.